So anyway, this is the introduction. Welcome everyone to Theology. This is the introductory session, and well, we've got a series of discussions, really, rather than lectures, I think. The next week we're going to have begin with the Vedanta tradition, so 2 weeks on that, because it's so important in Hinduism. And then we've got 3 weeks on Shaivism, because that's what I know about. And then the final session will be raising the question of theology in Hinduism, and the idea of theological reasoning across traditions and comparative philosophy. And we'll focus particularly on Frank Clooney's paper, which is in that book, Black Woman Companion to Hinduism, which I like to think was partly instrumental in his kind of trajectory down that route in comparative theology, because he began to think about those issues there. So today we're looking at what is Hindu theology, and an introduction to the scriptural traditions. So, I mean, both the terms of this course, this series of seminars, you don't have courses in Oxford, do you? You have papers or seminar series. So, are problematic. Both the terms Hindu and theology are problematic. Hindu because of its comparatively recent coinage in the history of Indian religions, and theology because it is a category developed within the history of Christianity, and some argue cannot be legitimately applied to other areas of the world. Philosophy is another term that we find used, and there's a long history of its use in relation to India. So Max Muller can compose a great thick book on the six systems of Indian philosophy. But nowhere until recently do we find the term theology applied to the Indian context. So Pereira, in José Pereira, inspired by Catholic scholasticism, compiled a wonderful anthology called Hindu Theology, Themes, Texts and Structures in 1976. And he may have been the first to coin the phrase Hindu theology. And Frank Clooney has developed the term, particularly raising the question whether there is a mode of discourse we can call Hindu theology, and if there is, whether it's worthwhile doing. We'll return to Clooney's ideas presently, but let's begin firstly with our term Hindu. Hindu, it comes from a Persian word Hind, or in Arabic Al-Hind, for the area of the Indus Valley, or just beyond the Indus Valley. And the term itself is derived from the Indo-Aryan Sindhu, meaning ocean or river. From the 8th century, Persians who settled in the Indus Valley distinguished between Muslims and non-Muslim Hindus. And Sanskrit sources are much later. In the 15th century in Kashmir, the Shaiva historian Srivara uses the term Hindu to distinguish Muslims from non-Muslims. And we find the term also in Bengali Vaishnava sources from the 16th century, so 100 years later, to denote those who are not Yavanas. Yavanas were the Muslims. So it could have probably denoted a range of cultural practices like cremation of the dead, certain styles of cuisine, not necessarily doctrinal positions, or perhaps belief in reincarnation, not sure. And it could have denoted Jains and Buddhists as well as Hindus, but it was to distinguish a certain group of people from the Yavanas, from the Muslims. And towards the end of the 18th century, Hindu, with two O's, was adopted by the British to refer to the people of what they called Hindustan, the area of northwest South Asia, who were not Parsis, Sikhs, Muslims or Christians. So it's kind of defined negatively in a way. And many now define Hindu sociologically as someone born into a particular endogamous section of Indian society. Now clearly then, the Hindu in Hindu theology is problematic, especially if we are reading Hindu theology back in time and talking about its roots in a very ancient past. The phrase Hindu theology also creates a certain illusion of unity, that there is a single coherent reference to the phrase, whereas in fact there is great diversity and multiplicity to Indian rational discourse. So for now, let us simply make the point that Hindu is a difficult category in itself. But leaving aside the coherence of the term Hindu for the moment, let us look at theology, the term theology. Alexander Piatigorsky argued that a discipline is defined by its object and or by its method. So if philosophy is thinking about thinking, then the object of philosophy is thought itself, and its method is rational analysis or argument. We might say that philology's object is language or text, and its method is philology itself, which encompasses practices such as critical emendation, etymology, grammar, and so on. Again, history is a term which encompasses both its object, history or the past, and its method, historical method, as the analysis of documents and so on. So what then is theology? Is theology a discipline like these others? If so, what is its object and what is its method? If a discipline is defined by its object and or its method, in what sense is theology a discipline? The traditional view put forward by Anselm is that theology is faith seeking understanding. If we look at the word itself, it comprises theos, a Greek word meaning God, and logos, meaning word, and with the implication of reason. So theology is reasoning, or we might say discourse, about God in its literal rendering. Theos is a masculine noun, so does this exclude God as female? And indeed, we do get in recent years a discourse about a God as female, theology. Thea rather than a theos. And David Ford describes theology very broadly, that, quote, theology deals with questions of meaning, truth, beauty and practice raised in relation to religions and pursued through a range of academic disciplines, end quote. So here, theology is not a single discipline, but a range of disciplines or an orientation towards questions of ultimate meaning. So in that sense, is it that different, in his view, from the study of religions, the academic study of religions? It's not clear, perhaps. But theology is clearly an academic discipline in the West, and like other disciplines, is given legitimacy by the broader social context in which it is found. The roots of modern academic theology are, of course, Christian history and theological language has developed as part of that history. Nicholas Lash, following Anselm's distinction, argues that theology, in contrast to philosophy, is a language of address. So philosophy is monologue, he says, and theology is dialogue. Now, I'm not sure that he's right about philosophy. So Rorty, for example, sees philosophy as conversation, which is surely dialogical. But Lash thinks that the primary characteristic of theological language is the language of address. It addresses an other beyond discourse, beyond the world, and beyond language. Although this claim itself is only constituted within language. So theology addresses a thou, whereas philosophy cannot address anything beyond the world. And perhaps that's a fair point. And as Simon Critchley says, philosophy is necessarily atheistic, arising out, quote, out of the experience of nihilism, end quote. So Simon Critchley perhaps provocatively argues that philosophy is inherently atheistic, as you could argue with sociology as well. It comes out of a scepticism towards transcendence.
Mm. Sociology has got, if you like, an agenda to do away with or eliminate religion.
Yeah, that's right.
Philosophy, does it share that?
Critchley thinks it does, but you know, we got philosophy of religion, haven't we?
Yes.
It's supposed to be open-minded and so on. But it's interesting. I mean, theology is clearly clearly about something outside of itself or transcendence. And according to Critchley anyway, philosophy, and indeed Nicholas Lash, philosophy is about the world and doesn't go outside
of
the world.
Metaphysics.
Yeah, metaphysics. Yeah. Question of the soul. Relation of the mind to the body, that's all. Yeah. Descartes was surely a philosopher. So perhaps he means modern philosophy. But I think for a moment, leaving philosophy aside, theology. Nicholas Lash's point about theology being the language of address is quite interesting, I think. And the language of address is also the language of analogy. based on the analogy of the being of God with the being of the world. So there's a, David Tracy wrote that great thick book, The Analogical Imagination, on the theological language as analogy. So God is a bit like this, in other words. So Ferry puts a problem of theological language, well, when echoing Anselm, he says that to speak of God in human language is not to speak of God, but to speak of worldly things drawn from human experience. So any talk of God on this view is actually only analogously speaking of God, because we can only speak of worldly things. Things drawn from human experience. But on the other hand, if theological language is not about finite things, then it becomes meaningless for human finitude, says Ferry. So if theological language is about something outside of us, then, he says, in a sense it's meaningless for us. What he calls univocal language, theological language is univocal or equivocal, is caught, Ferry claims, between anthropomorphism and agnosticism. So that's what Frederick Ferry claims is the problem of theological language. In that book, Language, Logic and God, must be about 20 years old now. So thus, univocal language he links to one's own experience, and so is no longer talk about God, whereas equivocal language attempts to cleanse terms for God of anthropomorphism, and so tends towards agnosticism. So he says there are these two tendencies in theological language, one which he calls univocal, which is trying to link one's experience with God, talking about one's experience as a way of talking about God, and what he calls equivocal, which is that attempts to cleanse language of anthropomorphism and speak of God in much more purer terms, purer theological categories. And the one tends towards anthropomorphism and the other tends towards agnosticism, because you don't know anything about God. Now, a third way between these kinds of language, he claims, is the logic of analogy. The abstraction of a characteristic from finite being applied to the infinite. Thus, God can be described as a father or king, for example, or love, or in some Hindu traditions as a mother, Matrika, or old crone, Kubjika, or a child, Bala. But while theological language addresses analogically a thou beyond the world, in a more concrete sense, it is language about revelation. So I would claim that rather than God as the object of theological discourse, it seems to me that revelation is both the object and source of theological inquiry. So Marianne Adams, I remember in a discussion a couple of years ago, said that theology was this discourse about God. But if God is unknowable, there's a wonderful, Weston Labarre was an anthropologist who had a wonderful quote. He coined this phrase that I remember. If God is unknowable, then theology is a science without subject matter. The theologians are ones who do not know what they are talking about. I can see his point in a way. If the object of theology is God, and God is unknowable, then it's a discourse without anything to talk about. But if that is not the object of theology, if God is not the object of theology, but rather the object of theology is revelation, then there's a lot to talk about, because you have revelation and the tradition that flows from it.
Revelation of what?
Revelation of what? Yeah, revelation is a sign of what? Pointed to something, to its source, which is...
You know, you're sort of deflecting or not facing the object.
Yeah.
If you say that it's revelation.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a way of getting around that problem.
Yeah, it's a way of not dealing with the problem.
Yeah, that's right. It is a way of not dealing with the problem. Yeah, that's right. Yeah. Yeah. yet it's saying that you can't say anything. If the object of revelation is a theos, is God, you can't say anything about that. So therefore there's nothing to talk about. But if you say the object of revelation, the object of theology is revelation, which you can debate what that is, and that it's the language of revelation, well, is then you're deferring the problem, as you say, is it the language of revelation points to a theos itself? Yes, this is a complex problem. But it seems to me if the object of theology is revelation rather than God, there's much more to say. And what is revelation? In Christianity, I suppose, Jesus Christ is the revelation that is alluded to, that is pointed to in the New Testament, whereas in Islam, the Quran itself is revelation. Or Judaism, the Tanakh, I think, probably would be regarded as revelation. You know, the Hebrew Bible. And the same question arises in Hinduism as well. So, anyway, that's difficult. It's a difficulty. Rather than God, it could be argued that revelation is both the object and source of theological inquiry. Theological inquiry, while being the language of analogy, is the language of interpretation of revelation. So theology is partly about interpretation and the interpretation of revelation, what it all means for us now, whenever that now is. So in Christianity, that revelation is arguably not the Bible itself, but Christ, who is borne witness in the New Testament, who is the revelation that the New Testament bears witness to. But other religions have different revelations. So the Quran is the object of Islamic theology. And likewise, it could be argued that Hindu theology has the revelation of the Veda as its object, but I'll return to this point presently. So anyway, that's a question. That's what is theology? What's the object of theology? Is theology a discipline? And if it's a discipline, is it defined by its method, or by its object, or by both? What is the method of theology? Can there be a method in theology? Someone like Lonergan argued that there could be, that theology is a method, but someone like George Patterson argues that theology isn't a method. You could say then that theology, academic theology anyway, is a second order discourse that reflects on and responds to a first order discourse, which is revelation, and we might add tradition. That is, we can understand theology as a discourse whose object is revelation and the traditions of practice and interpretation that flow from it. On this view, theological language comes from, yet stands outside, the tradition that has given rise to it. There is then a critical distance between theology and the practices and fundamental doctrines of Christianity, for example, particularly modern theology taught in universities. So you've got a first-order discourse, which is like the revelation and the tradition that flows from it, which includes all the practices of the tradition, like asceticism, prayer, pilgrimage and so on. Liturgy.
What's the difference? You said academic theology. What's the difference between academic theology and theology?
I was using academic theology as a development of the last 100 or 200 years and taught in universities. Yeah, it's taught in universities.
As opposed to monastic
theology, yeah. Because there, I mean, the theology in that sense, say, Eastern Orthodox, Mount Athos or something, I think theology is still part of what I would call a first order, first level discourse, part of the tradition in a way. Oh, it's difficult, it's, yeah. Or perhaps you've got two, well, anyway, we can debate about this, perhaps you've got the tradition and the practices of prayer, asceticism, and so on. And in a sense, theology, in a traditional sense, is still a practice, is a practice of theology. It's a reflection. But theology as an academic discipline, that's a practice too, but arguably it's a second-order discourse because of its critical distance from its roots or from its object. It's reflective. And I, arguably, there's a book called Jensen. Systematic theology. He talks about this too, to some extent. I think he agrees that theology is a second order discourse. But I'd have to check that out. So you could say that theological issues of the 21st century will not be those of the 16th century. So there's a critical distance between theology and the tradition. So this idea of theology as a second-order discourse brings it closer to religious studies as the academic study of religions. Although religious studies is, I think, a third-order discourse or meta-discourse that reflects the second and first-order discourses. Thus, according to Heidegger, we have four religious philosophical disciplines: psychology, epistemology, philosophy of history, and metaphysics, which is authentic philosophy of religion for him. But that's that's a story for another day. Religious studies as a third order discourse. That reflects upon second-order discourses and as well as first-order discourses. Now, if my characterization of theology is accurate, does this fit with Hindu traditions? I think it does, although there's no exact historical parallel in India, as Frank Clooney observes. Clearly, we have the idea of revelation or Shruti, and we have tradition that flows from it, Smriti, Amnaya, Shrutas, Parampara, Sampradaya, and other terms. We also have rational discourse about these traditions. Thus, for example, Nabi Navagupta in the 10th century categorizes the tantric revelation into various groups flowing from one of Shiva's five mouths, and reflects upon the meaning of these traditions, arranging them in a hierarchy of revelation. There is then clearly reflection upon revelation and its meaning, and what for shorthand we might call Hindu traditions. The Mimamsakas, for example, were deeply concerned with what revelation was and what is entailed by it. And although the Mimamsa is an atheistic system, it is theology in the sense that I've described above. So the Mimamsaka, if that doesn't have a theos as its object, because it's an atheistic tradition, it's near Ishvara, but it has a great discourse about revelation. The Veda has revelation, revelation of itself, and that's its main object, is the Veda as revelation, discourse about it. So the revelation of the Veda, the Shruti, that which is heard, has no beginning and has no end, but it's received by receptive human beings called the sages, the rishis, and then communicated to human beings. And so the Mimamsaka is a second-order discourse reflecting on the meaning of that and what it's all about. What is revelation? And they come up fundamentally. Revelation is injunction, vidi, do this and don't do that. Which is actually quite insightful about the nature of religions.
Do you make any distinction between atheism and non-theistic?
That's a good distinction, yeah. I was just using it in a broad sense of a transcendent God who is the source of the universe, if you like, or who sustains it. That's rejected by the Mimamsakas, although they're not atheistic in the sense that they have different gods, and they're quite happy with the gods. Although some of them, like, what was his name? I can't remember his name, but one of the Mimamsakas thought that the gods were simply names in language, mm-hmm. had no external reality other than terms in the text, which is quite a sort of postmodern view, really. But yes, you, when I say Mimamsaka is atheistic, you have to qualify that and explain what you mean by it. It's not Karl Marx or Freud. Oh, Buddhism again. Likewise, even Buddhism might be understood as theology in this sense, in that it has revealed texts, the Mahayana Sutras, for example, that are commented upon through the generations, but it doesn't have a theos as its object. I like Frank Clunie's characterization of theology as, in a Hindu context, as a kind of reasoning located between attention to sacred texts and meditation. So it's shravana, it's hearing, and it's meditation, nididhyasana. And he lists some, and also thinking, manana, thinking about, reflecting on what you've heard. And he lists seven themes that are characteristic of Hindu theology that we might like to bear in mind over the coming weeks. And these themes, he thinks, help us define Hindu theology. And these themes are: A, the nature of a sufficient world cause, world maker. So theology as theos, as the object of theology there. The nature of the world maker. Whether God is one or many, particular problem for Hinduism perhaps. C, divine embodiment. D, the problem of evil, problem for all theologies surely. And E, the nature of time and of liberation. And F, the appeal to revelation. And G, ignorance as a theological category. So ignorance isn't particularly a theological category in Western theology, whereas sin is, but ignorance is certainly a theological category, it seems, in the Indian traditions. There is clearly an overlap here with traditional philosophy of religion. My own view would be that we cannot make much sense of A, B or C, the world maker, whether God is one or many, or divine embodiment, except insofar as they are objects within tradition and revelation, that revelation somehow tells us about these things, and theology reflects upon that, the meaning of that. Because there's no discourse about God outside of language, which is tradition-specific, it seems to me. You can't talk about God in... philosophy of religion tries to do so, I suppose, in purely neutral terms or purely abstract terms. You could argue that there can be no rational discourse about these topics outside of particular traditions and languages. There can, I think, be comparative theology, but this would be to create another kind of shared language or discourse. To do comparative theology, you have to share a language, or you have to create a shared language to do do comparative theology. Indeed, comparative theology might well be a third-order discourse in the sense I've alluded to above. So how do you do comparative theology is another question we can perhaps look at. One model that I think is quite interesting is scriptural reasoning developed by Peter Oakes, that people from different religions sit round and read their text together, and that tends to create a shared language emerges out of that reading. It's quite an interesting process, but that takes a long time. It's many years, I think, really, to get anywhere with that. Well, I suppose history has plenty of time. These religions have got a long time. They've been around for a long time. Now, in Indian history, then, there have clearly been theologies in the sense described here, but the extent to which there are still Hindu theologies today with the rigour of those earlier discourses is a moot point. Indeed, and this, I think, we can discuss in the last week, contemporary Hindu theologies would need to engage with Western theological traditions in order to be globally relevant and investigate contemporary theological concerns. Conversely, Western theologies need to engage with the theologies of other religions to be relevant in the global context. So certainly in the history of Indian thinking, of Indian rational discourse, there was a what they call a Vada tradition. Vada means discourse, from the root vad, to speak. And these traditions were certainly by the 11th century, were very aware of each other, and there was a rigorous debate between them. And there were commentarial traditions, so they comment on scripture and they comment on commentaries. So that's the nature, the style of these theological inquiries. And the point of these discourses is partly to clarify difference. They're not interested in consensus. They're not interested in agreement. They're interested in winning the argument and clarifying the difference between these often mutually exclusive positions. So let's look at the Sanskrit analogies for the term theology and philosophy. The most common term translated as philosophy is darshana. Thus we have the famous six darshanas, although there are more than six. And darshana also refers to Buddhist, Jain and materialist philosophies as well, the Lokayatas. And there's a book about 1340 or so by Madhva called the Sarva Darshana Sangraha, the compendium of all philosophies or all world views, composed about 1340, and that's an excellent summary of various philosophical systems in India. And that includes the Shaiva systems, because the six systems of Indian philosophy classically exclude the Shaiva systems, but the Madhva's text includes the Shaiva systems. We also have the term anvikshiki for nyaya inquiry, logical analysis, and tarka, again, which refers to logical argument. And there are other terms such as matter, teaching or thought, and particularly vada, I think, which I probably didn't write on the thing then. Discourse. We might then restrict Hindu theology to those systems that accept the Veda as revelation, the Astika systems, as opposed to those that reject it, the Nastika systems, and also to those who respond to the Veda within the tradition. Thus the Shaiva theologies relegate the Veda to a lower level of revelation, with the Shaiva tantras as the higher revelation, as we'll see. So all of these traditions tended to hierarchize their revelation. So the Veda and Puranas, that's Samanya, that's common revelation, that's just for what we all share. It's very basic, very fundamental. But there's Vishesha revelation, particular revelations for those of higher understanding, as it were. And we'll look at those in due course. So Hindu traditions then clearly have a revelation shruti and a discourse about it. And this revelation is Veda. The Veda. Veda means knowledge and is related to the Greek oida, I think. And English wit, witness, German wissen, probably Hungarian words as well. And in the post-Vedic medieval times, the four Vedas are called Shruti. So in the early century CE, I think, the Vedas come to be referred to as Shruti, something heard or revealed to the primordial sages, the rishis, and which contrasts with Smriti, something remembered or learned by heart, which refers to the post-Upanishadic texts such as the Sutras or Manu's law book, the Manu Smriti. Effectively, many Smriti texts are revered as having equal status to Shruti, as we see with the Bhagavad Gita or later the Bhagavata Purana, which are technically Smriti, but they're treated as Shruti by devotees. There are various layers to the Veda, which it's probably not necessary to describe. You know about the Vedas. Yeah, you know about the Vedas. Good. So the Upanishads then are the final layer of the Veda, and that's called the Vedanta, the end of the Veda. And they offer philosophical reflection on, and so in a sense are the first theology in Hinduism.
First philosophy.
First theology, first philosophy. Rational reflection. Rational analysis. And they contain secret teachings, Upanishad, arguably secret teachings, by a variety of late Vedic teachers, and offer speculation about the nature of the world, what happens at death, and the earliest discussions of reincarnation and action, nature of action. And then you get a group of texts called the Sutras, which are really part of the Vedic corpus. And one text in particular, the Brahma Sutras by Bhadarayana, is particularly important. Indeed, to found a school of theology or philosophy, you had to write a commentary on that text, to found the Sampradaya. So if you wrote a commentary on that text, it was recognized that you were founding a philosophical school. So hence we have a variety of theologies that can be distinguished from each other through the commentarial tradition, and a very long conversation spanning generations and indeed thousands of years. And the conversation carried on down into the 18th century largely, but by the 19th century those conversations were largely in contraction, not completely eliminated. But and then you get the rise of Neo-Hinduism, the Hindu Renaissance, which is an intellectual impoverishment compared to what went before. And you get, well, we know that story into modernity. No, the Upanishads then emerge from the Brahmanas, and their kind of thinking about correspondence develops ideas about liberation from suffering and the prevention of rebirth rather than re-death. And the earliest Upanishad is the Brihadaranyaka, which presents its teachings dialogically, and the last canonical text is the Shvetashvatara. And I've given you, sorry for going on too long, and I've got the texts. Let's look at that first one, the Brihadaranyaka Upanishad, chapter 4. These are double sided. Does your first one begin? Oh yeah, here it is. So chapter 4. Once when Janaka, the king of Videha, was formally seated, Yajnavalkya, who's probably the first Hindu theologian, came up to him. Janaka asked him, Yajnavalkya, why have you come? Are you after cows or subtle disquisitions? Because he won a debate earlier, and he won 1,000 cows or something. He replied, both, your majesty. That's interesting that he should reply. He wants his cows. Let's hear what they have told you. Brahman is speech. That is what Jitvan Shainani told me, said Janaka, the king. Shainani told you Brahman is speech? Why, that's like someone telling that he has a father or a mother or a teacher. He probably reasoned, what could a person who cannot speak possibly have? But did he tell you what its abode and foundation are? He did not tell me that. Then that is a one-legged Brahman, your majesty. Why didn't you tell us that yourself, Yajnavalkya? Speech itself is its abode, and space is its foundation. One should venerate it as knowledge. What constitutes knowledge, Yajnavalkya? Speech itself, your majesty, he replied. For surely, your majesty, it is through speech that we come to know a counterpart. Rig Veda, Yajur Veda, Sama Veda, and Atharva Angiras, and the Atharva Angiras, the texts of the Atharva Veda, histories, ancient tales, sciences, hidden teachings, verses, aphorisms, explanations and glosses, offerings and oblations, food and drink, this world and the next world, and all beings. It is through speech, your majesty, that we come to know these things. So clearly, your majesty, the highest Brahman is speech. When a man knows and venerates it as such, speech never abandons him, and all beings flock to him. He becomes a god and joins the company of gods. Janaka of Videha exclaimed, I'll give you 1,000 cows together with bulls and elephants. So, I wish we valued knowledge so highly in this culture.
When you say that it is through speech that we come to know a counterpart, does he mean that there is an object that you are discovering in speech, the counterpart is the other?
Yes, I think that's what he means. Yeah, I think he means the other. like the counterpart. But it's very interesting that the first thing that comes in this discourse is speech. Vach. So the counterpart, yes, I think to have I think this is an insight that to have language, you have to have an other.
What's the Sanskrit for that?
Yeah, just have a look. Just be that. Samraj, it says here, Samraj Pandu. Yep. In the ancient histories and all that, that's Puranas, ancient tales, Vidya, sciences, Vidya, Upanishad. Itihasa. It's interesting that it mentions these texts, which are supposed to come after the Upanishads. So it's not the ancient Puranas, whether it means the Puranas or whether it is the Puranas, just ancient tales.
Doesn't Oligol give a gloss?
No, he doesn't. Well, he gives a translation, but he doesn't. There's no notes or anything on that. So that's interesting. Right at the beginning, you've got speech. And then he goes through various things after speech. And he goes through the breath. Brahman is breath. Because Yajnavalkya doesn't accept his cows, i.e. the implication that although that's true, what he's just said, it's only a relative truth. He hasn't actually got to the heart of the matter yet. Let's hear what else they have told you, these other teachers. And Brahman is breath. That's what Udanka Shalbayana told me, said Janaka. Why, that is like someone telling that he has a father, a mother, or a teacher. It's interesting, the genre, you get this pattern repeated, as is typical in all kind of traditions. What could a person who cannot breathe possibly have? But did he tell you what its abode and foundation are? He did not tell me that. Then it's a one-legged Brahman, Your Majesty. Why don't you tell us that yourself, Yajnavalkya? You can see him angling for the king to ask him this kind. Breath itself is its abode, and space is its foundation. One should venerate it as deer. What constitutes deer? Breath itself, Your Majesty, he replied. For surely, priya, deer, priya. For surely, Your Majesty, it is for the love of one's breath that one officiates at the sacrifice of a man at whose sacrifices one is forbidden to officiate, or accepts gifts from a man from whom one is forbidden to accept gifts. And if a man is afraid of getting killed when he travels somewhere, Your Majesty, it is because he loves his breath. So clearly, Your Majesty, the highest Brahman is breath. When a man knows and venerates it as such, breath never abandons him, and all beings flock to him. He becomes a god and joins the company of gods. And so on. He goes through all of these. Brahman is sight and truth. and then hearing, so all these various things. The mind.
These must have been various concepts that were in play at the time when he's drawing them together.
Yes, yes. I think these were. It's a bit like the Greeks. What's the essence of the universe? And these were possible answers that other people had given. And then bliss. You go to bliss. And then finally, he gets to the heart. And then at section two, he then goes on to discuss the what happens at death. And finally, he gets to page 57 there. He gets to the self, the Atman, which is the essence of things. And about this self, one can only say, not, 1880. He is ungraspable, for he cannot be grasped. He is undecaying, for he is not subject to decay. He has nothing sticking to him, for he does not stick to anything. He is not bound, yet he neither trembles in fear nor suffers injury. Truly, Janaka, you have attained freedom from fear. So the self, part of this discourse is about the Atman, is about the self. And this is the heart of the text, really, that it's about the self, which is in your heart, which is your fundamental true nature.
It is about Brahman.
Yeah.
The highest Brahman.
Yeah, which is identical with your Atman in this context. Yeah. Yeah. So it's a kind of mystic, the earliest Upanishad.
But they already know it, if you see what I mean. Because they've already given a name.
Yeah.
They've already given a name to something which, in a way, they don't know.
Yes, they've given a name to.
To the unnameable.
To the unnameable. The impossible. Maybe Tracy speaks about the impossible. And then it's interesting, but I thought we just briefly contrast what we just read with the Shvetashvatara Upanishad, the last canonical, sort of classical Upanishad, if you like, or the one that's in the canon. And
we've got a copy of it.
Sorry, turn it around.
Yeah,
yeah.
Oh, yeah.
We've got chapter one. This is, I mean, that what we just read was about 800 BC. This is difficult today, but probably about the first, second century BC. And here we've got very parallel to the Bhagavad Gita, really. There's a German scholar, Oberlis, I think he's dated it to the first or second century. What makes people who make inquiries about Brahman say, what is the cause of Brahman? Why were we born? By what do we live? On what are we established? Governed by whom? Are you who know Brahman, do we live in pleasure and in pain, each in our respective situation? Should we regard it as time, as inherent nature, as necessity, as chance, as the elements, as the source of birth? Or as the person, the Purusha, the cosmic person, I suppose. Or is it a combination of these? But that can't be, because there is the self, the Atman. Even the self is not in control, because it is itself subject to pleasure and pain. So the very interesting questions raised at the beginning of this text. These speculations about why is there something rather than nothing almost, really? Why were we born? What is the nature of the absolute?
But it's more sophisticated in its inquiry than the other one.
Yes, more sophisticated in its inquiry than the other one, yes. Mm. That's right. Yeah. These are real theological questions, if you like, it seems to me. So right back here at the roots of the tradition, you've got these, what would be recognised as theological questions, I would have thought. Philosophical questions, yes, but
they're not about God, though.
No, they're not about God. No, that's right. but about the foundation or the underlying essence of the universe. Yep. But in the next section, those who follow the discipline of meditation have seen God, Ishvara, the self, Atman, and the power, Shakti, I think, all hidden by their own qualities. So here you've got three realities which you get in later traditions, particularly in Shaivism, between God, the self, and power, Shakti. One alone is he who governs all those causes from time to self. So you could argue that it's not a coherent theology being presented here, but it's certainly throwing out a lot of things. And here's a fairly incomprehensible section of the text. We study it, i.e. that God, as a wheel that is one limb and threefold, with 16 tips, 50 spokes, 20 counterspokes, and 6 sets of 8, whose single rope is of many forms, that divides itself into 3 different paths, and whose delusion regarding the one springs from 2 causes. Now that's a difficult passage. I don't think there are any agreements as to the meaning of all of that. At least Olivel translates these terms in a kind of English. I mean, there was some translations are in technical vocabulary of wheels. They talk about fellies and axles. And so, do you know what a felly is? You don't know what. No. It's the outer rim of a wheel, apparently. So anyway, as a river whose waters are the 5 sense organs, whose fierce crocodiles are the 5 sources of birth, whose waves are the 5 breaths, whose primal source is the 5 types of perception, which has 5 whirlpools, whose rapid current is the 5 types of sorrow, which divides itself in 50 ways, which have become 5 sections. Now, some of that you can make sense of, but some of it, like the 50 ways, I don't know what that refers to. But the point is that within this vast wheel of Brahman, on which all subsists and which abides in all, a goose, a hamsa, or swan, keeps moving around. And that's the self, the hamsa, the goose. We have such a... It's culture, isn't it? We have such weird connotations of the goose. Those kind of somewhat stupid creatures rather than beautiful, graceful things that squawk at you when you try to put them away. So when he perceives himself, Atman, as distinct from the impeller, delighted by that knowledge, he goes from there to immortality. So this is a kind of theistic text. You've got a kind of early theism here. You've got this Brihadaranyaka, which is fairly monistic, where the Atman and the Brahman seem to be coextensive. And then you've moved several hundred years later to the Shvetashvatara, which is raising, as you were saying, sophisticated questions, which are arguably theological questions, or questions that would be recognized as theology by some, by Christianity, in a way.
But isn't it now a second order?
Yeah.
Because it's reflecting on itself, on how we come to think about or study, as it says.
Yes, I think so.
Use analogies.
Yeah,
that's and then we make this distinction between the self that studies and what we're studying.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. I think you could say that. That you've got that this text is a theological text, which is a sort of second order discourse in a way, about the nature of God, or no, I hesitate to say that, but the nature of Brahman. But it does speak about Ishvara, and these three realities of self, Ishvara, and power. But there is a sense in which underlying them, they're still united by some underlying force or power. So, food for thought. We've actually technically come to the end of our hour, I think. So looking at these texts, do you think this is theology or is this something else?
Something else.
Something else.
It's from out of which theology may or may not emerge.
Yeah. Yeah. It's the raw material, as it were. Yeah.
The early one particularly is a bit too literary.
Yes.
It's telling a story. Me.
Yes, it's telling a story.
It's telling a story, and it's not as dry as you would expect theology to be.
No, but it's a dialogue. It's using a method, isn't it? I mean, the way to reach Brahman is through dialogue.
Yeah.
You know, you were saying about the other.
Mm.
And it's this sort of separation, isn't it?
Yes, you mean it's reporting a conversation.
You can only reach it by kind of interacting or with something other than yourself. Or
yeah.
Something outside yourself.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's what that it, yes, it's fundamentally dialogical. And you're also monistic. And perhaps we're asking for consistency when we shouldn't really. And indeed there are commentaries upon these texts which off of different interpretations,
yeah.
Monistic and dualistic interpretations.
Also seeing it as an evolution, evolving of process.
Yeah.
You know, you go through various stages, then it's obviously an earlier stage to a later stage, which is to say is more, or appears more sophisticated.
I think that's right, that, that there's a history of ideas in India which the West has sometimes neglected or forgotten. Yes, certainly, yes, yes. Well, thanks everybody. So next week we'll carry on with the Vedanta. Should I turn this?
I don't know how to.
Okay. Well, thanks for coming, everyone. I'm sorry there's so few of us here.
Do you produce the text, or do you want us to read the text before?
Oh, I'll produce it. I'll produce it. We can just go through it next week.
You're the producer.
Rather than...